Welcome to the Let's Clear the Air Energy Podcast. Conversations focused on how some of the world's top energy leaders are innovating to deliver clean, affordable, and reliable energy for the future.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for joining us on the latest edition of the Let's Clear the Air Energy Podcast. My name is Adam Murray. I'm joined by Stuart Salters and Brian Nix. And we have a wonderful guest today, Mr. Doug Sheridan. Doug, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. I hope you guys are.
Too bad. Not too bad. For those who don't know, Doug is the managing director and founder of Energy Point Research based in Houston, Texas. He has published and cited in various news publications, including the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, CNBC, a good list of folks there. He has a tremendous background in energy, energy transition, energy policy, corporate finance, data analysis, and others. He holds degrees from Vanderbilt University, as well as the University of Michigan Ross School of Business. So, Doug, thanks for joining. And we always like to start off the show with a little Let's Clear the Air, just a way for people to get to know you. And so we kind of try and go back and forth on that. But I think a good question for today is, what's your biggest fear? What's something that you're not necessarily excited about?
So it's a good question. It's kind of timely, actually, for me. I guess I haven't really thought about it that much. Obviously, I think geopolitical issues can get, obviously, to the extent that they got away from us. I'd hate for this generation or energy and any generation to have to deal with a global climate conflict because they can be so damaging. So I'd say, you know, down deep, that's probably the biggest thing that I worry about. But I have recently had an experience where I was taking an online course with a very good professor on storytelling. And it was just writing a storytelling, something that I'm interested in. I write a lot. And she was a great instructor. And we had assignments each week, and I did them all, which proves that once a teacher's pet, always a teacher's pet. And when she ended the course, she said, I can't really require you guys to do this, but a thing in storytelling right now is for writers to take the time and write down 5 or 10 minutes worth of stand-up comedy material and then go perform it. And that was the assignment. That was what she left us with. And so there were about 15 people in the class, and we found it interesting, a bit shocked. And then we continued to push her a little bit and said, because she made the case, she said, you know, storytelling is there's commonalities between comedy because you've got to think in terms of what do you include, what not, what's your timing and that kind of thing. And so she made that case. And then we kept pushing and said, is that it? And she said, actually, there's another thing. And she said, each of you may be good writers and probably some of you are, but regardless of how good you are going to submit a transcript to somebody at some point and they're going to throw it right in the trash. They're going to think it's terrible. And you need to toughen your skin, and there's no better way than to go up in front of a crowd with a good joke and just bomb. She said, it will toughen you up and you'll be ready. And so it was the last thing we were really thinking, but we said, thanks. And so I have yet to take the advice, but I like to think that if I don't do it, it'll be the only assignment that she gave us that I didn't do. So we'll see. Check in the next 6 months or so, and I might have a story for you.
Nice. You have the joke lined up yet, though?
So I have friends of mine who are prodding me, and I have decided to commit, at the very least, to start writing down my funny thoughts as they go on. And, you know, if you've ever seen the show Comedian, the documentary Comedian by Jerry Seinfeld, he started with all new material after he quit the show, and he took months and months to just craft, you know, 5 or 10 minutes. And so I'm not really putting a lot of pressure on myself to get this done quickly, because I think that would be a recipe for disaster. So I am starting to write them. I haven't practiced anything on anybody, not even myself in the mirror, but we'll see. You know, maybe there's a new career out there that I'll stumble into, and you guys will be watching me for other reasons.
Hold on. I need to add that to your bio here. Comedian.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. aspiring comic.
That's awesome. Yeah, well, we do appreciate you coming on, Doug, and chatting with us. So I'm here in Washington, D.C., and when you think about all the political footballs that people use here in DC, the climate, the Paris Climate Accords, the Paris Climate Agreement, whatever you want to call it, is one that's kind of been a political football. You've done a lot of research into this and have some good intimate knowledge of these, of those agreements. Can you share a little bit about your thoughts on the agreement? Were the goals that were set back in 2015 the right ones? Any thoughts you might have on that?
Sure. So it's important to kind of understand the history of not only the Paris Climate Agreement, but the conference and parties that where these are the sessions where these things are crafted. And so before Paris, there were a number of them. One in particular was in Copenhagen in 2009 that didn't go very well. And so it came out, what came out of that was there was going to be a better process and there was going to be better buy-in. And so they began to focus really hard on the process. And so a lot of people don't realize it, but if you read the accounts of the parties who were the people who were leading that particular conference, it was almost a foregone conclusion that the Paris Accord would be signed because it had been negotiated and wrestled for so long amongst the nations and the parties, they call them, that there was just smaller things. There were just a few things that needed to be dealt with. So the answer to the question in terms of the Paris Accord, I think it was very much driven by the science. I think the scientists had a front row seat in those sessions. And if you talk to them, essentially what came out of the Paris Accord immediately was to do what was necessary and get the pledges from the 196 nations that were participating parties to keep global emissions below, excuse me, global temperatures below 2.0 degrees Celsius over and above pre-industrial levels. That was pretty quickly reduced to 1.5 because of a cushion for safety, and 2.0 was deemed unacceptable by scientists, or certainly a bit risky. And so it was really the 1.5. And so when you look at the numbers at the time, the Paris Accord, the Paris Agreement emissions in the annual emissions were about 48.8 gigatons CO2 equivalent of greenhouse gases. And so since then, if you look, fast forward 10 years, they have actually risen about 11%. They were 54 gigatons at the end of 2024. Now, what the agreement had contemplated, consistent with success, is that those emissions would fall to about 28 gigatons by 2030. And that would have been a 43% reduction from the levels that existed in 2015. So what we got is, instead of a 43% decline, we actually got 11% increase. And so, you know, in the world of private business, that would be considered, in my mind, an unsuccessful project, right? That's you didn't accomplish what you were hoping for. And if you were to look in terms of sort of why that was the case, we can talk about that and sort of what was going on in sort of the heads of the delegates and the parties who were leading it. But the fact of the matter is that the Paris Accord really didn't achieve much, if anything, of what was hoped for when it was signed.
Yeah, I was just going to, quick follow up. Is that like globally they didn't achieve what they wanted to achieve, or are you thinking more of the United States? Or
so it's a good question. So it would be there's only six nations maybe it is, that have actually to this point achieved what they said they were going to do, because the process worked. The way it worked was there would be voluntary emissions goals set out by each of the 196 nations, and at this point, no industrialized nation has achieved that. There's only been six that have in their countries, like Nepal and Nigeria and I believe Costa Rica and a few others, but none of them are the big names in terms of climate emissions. So it's really a global thing, right? And so it's, and that's just tracking along where you should be. The real objective is, I think, to get to 2050 for these parties and the people in the delegates. And that's when you would achieve this so-called net zero by 2050. But no countries, and certainly no large countries and large emitters, are on track to achieve what were their voluntary goals, which a lot of the a lot of the participants in the party in the conference want to say we're actually legally binding. There's some question in that. And I think the United States has kind of proven that it wasn't legally binding. And it certainly, it would have had the treaty was never ratified by the Senate, which is a requirement. And if the U.S. isn't going to do it, then other parties feel like they're not necessarily obligated as well.
So, Doug, you mentioned that, you know, kind of science was driving the first of this, and scientists and the data that they had. I mean, you know, they speak in terms of reducing emissions and reducing global temperatures, but pragmatically, you know, that has to do with every country's growth and their energy usage and everything that's wrapped around that. So it's kind of a global thing that everybody's trying to do, but in reality, there are some key things you have to do. Do you think that the, you know, the goals were flawed or just over, you know, there's no one was going to be able to actually do that from the start?
Good question. So I think scientifically they were probably on target, but that's in a vacuum. Practically, I think they were never realistic in the first place. And I think there was not an appreciation for why the energy system exists as it does. I think there's a perception amongst scientists that there's a lot of waste in the energy sector, and that to some extent the fossil fuel industry has been fighting tooth and nail to keep any better solutions coming to market, and, you know, kind of a conspiracy theory thing type there amongst some, not everybody. But I just don't think there's an appreciation for the fact that in the energy industry, you know, I was in the midstream side, but even there, we were pretty much agnostic in terms of sort of, we didn't think in terms of, you know, doing what it took to burn more natural gas in our compressors. We did the things, or our processing plants, we did the things that made sense for us. And a lot of times that was electric, actually. And so, you know, we had a lot of, I was in San Juan Basin, we had a lot of electric compression up there. And we even took one of the inlet compressors for the processing plant, large processing plant, and it ran on electric too. And they were great units. And so we did it because it was economic. And so I think that extends to really the entire energy spectrum. The energy spectrum was making decisions based on energy, based on the characteristics of the energy source that best fit their needs. And if there were better solutions for decades in the past, and certainly going forward, to the energy that we're using now, parties had tremendous incentive to do it, to chase those and try to do it. The energy market, you know, put a number on it. It's probably annually up towards $10 trillion a year. You put a market value on the parties that do that, that's certainly in the tens of trillions. These companies absolutely, and these players have absolutely incentive, always had incentive to try to do things that were more efficient and more practical. And so as a result, there just wasn't a lot of low-hanging fruit to try to change the processes just because the climate began to warm. We just didn't have those options. And I think in the scientific community, they thought there were a lot of options that could be taken and could be taken economically. The other thing I'd mention briefly is that I think there was an understanding to the extent that prices, costs would rise as a result of trying to deal with climate change, that those rising costs would be considered tolerable. And I think the fact of the matter is that there's only a small amount of those costs that would in fact be deemed tolerable. At some point, both the public and business institutions would say, this just isn't workable for us. And the risk would be that you would begin to sort of start to drive the global economy into the ditch. And no one, that's not going to be tolerable.
Yeah, that's an interesting comment. I was looking at crude prices this week and crude prices in 2005, and they're essentially the same. I mean, they haven't, the price of crude was $70 right then, and it's $70 today, give or take.
If inflation adjusted, it's even lower, right?
Yeah, totally. All right. So staying online here, when the Paris agreements were made, I think it was something like 85, 86% of, you know, global energy consumption was fossil fuels. Has that changed at all, given the tremendous investment in wind, solar, nuclear, et cetera?
It's changed, you know, generously, you could say it's changed modestly. It's really more of a minor change. The background on that is, you know, what is sort of the transition here? And it's broken down into kind of the electrify everything effort. That's where you get sort of the movement towards the world in which you move towards EVs, you move towards heat pumps, you move towards electric appliances and that kind of thing. And then sort of the second part of that would be biofuels, to the extent that you couldn't cover the transportation, difficult transportation, which would be long haul ground transportation, air travel, and then shipping on the water, waterborne shipping. Those are all industries where it's very difficult to electrify. And so the answer there early on was that you just use biofuels. And then third is the idea that you could get some gains through efficiency gains and conservation and that kind of thing. And so that was, in essence, the game plan to try to reduce fossil fuels. The fact of the matter is fossil fuel use has fallen from the 86.5, I think it is, that you mentioned, and it's about 81.5% now of total primary energy use. And so I would argue that the low-hanging fruit has already been plucked. That level of decline seems to be decelerating. The other thing is that none of the components, none of the fuels that comprise fossil fuels, whether it's coal, whether it's natural gas, or whether it's oil, have fallen since the Paris Climate Agreement. And that has, I think it's actually grown by about 10%, maybe plus or minus something. And so, those are up. Even the IEA has reversed itself and has said that it believes that consumption of coal, which is kind of the bad guy on the scene, right, will continue to rise through at least 2027. And that overwrites expectations and projections by the IEA previously that it would begin its steady decline in the middle of this decade. And so, even coal's surprising. And so it's hard to look at something and saying, we're working on this and we're winning, when the very thing that you're trying to do, which is to reduce coal, is continuing to grow. And so the other thing we can talk about, I won't mention it now, is part of the problem is that when you incentivize renewables through subsidies, all you're really doing is sort of creating more energy. And so you get a new component in the mix, which then drives fossil fuels down a little bit on a percentage basis, but they're still rising on an absolute basis. And so ultimately, that's what drives emissions. Until you can reduce the fuels that are supposedly the problem from emission standpoint, you're not really doing anything, regardless of what the percentage is.
Yeah, it's been a couple of years, or maybe a year ago, we had Dr. Scott Tinker on, and he was talking about, it's not really an energy transition as you're just describing. It's really energy growth, right? We're adding new sources of energy through solar, biofuels, et cetera, but all that's doing is just adding to the pie. We're not really lowering anything per se. And I think that
a lot of that's driven by the policies they've chosen and the technologies they've chosen to try to emphasize in the strategy.
So I was going to ask, going back to kind of some of the earlier conversation we had, it does seem like there wasn't as much, maybe I'm projecting too much, but I guess, what are your thoughts on the consideration of affordability, reliability, whether here in the U.S. or globally, or folks that are making some of these policies or have involvement in energy policy, thinking more about those aspects and those impacts on consumers?
Well, I don't think that those issues were discussed at all in Paris when they came up with the Paris Accord. I don't think that affordability and reliability, sustainability, we think in terms of, the triad, right? That's sort of the trilemma, right? The sustainability, affordability, and reliability. They're looking only at sustainability. They were only looking at the piece on the emission side. They figured the market or the politicians would handle the others. And so they just came out and said, scientifically, this is what we need to do. And so the nations came out and said, okay, this is what we're willing to contribute. And they summed it all up and said that we can get there if everybody does what they say they're going to do. But the problem is that politicians that agreed to do this really kind of got caught up in the moment, I think, and it was quite the moment. And there was no real capability for us to actually, and for nations to get to that, to get to those levels, unless they were willing to compromise on either the affordability or the reliability or both. And so there's two countries or two areas that I'll point to. I'll point to the UK and I'll point to Europe. And so parties need to understand that the politicians in those countries, they have a different mindset in terms of what the goals are with the transition. And these countries that economically, if you look at them, they represent both Europe and the UK. They've really begun the struggle economically. As a percentage of global GDP, those countries have continued to decline. And so the fact of the matter is their relevance on the global change, a global platform, global arena has begun to change. And they believed, and still do to this day, believe that if they can show leadership on the issue of net zero and green issues, that their leadership will somehow, and for some reason, catapult them back to the top of the geopolitical pecking order. They believe that by taking leadership, even to the point of we look at it and we say, guys, you're deindustrializing your nations, it's not going well. The point is that they believe they're going to have currency from the parties who were first to net zero, right? Politicians, persons like Boris Johnson and others, and you can go back to even some of the others before that, certainly with the parties that they have running now, they don't understand energy, right? They understand politics and they understand geopolitical issues, and they say, gee, if we could somehow claim the mantle of net zero and show that we could be green and still keep our heads above water at best, I'd argue, we will then have essentially the high ground, and we will then become a lead back, we'll be back up at the top of the pecking order on a geopolitical basis. And so it is a bad gamble. You can still see it in what's going on with those countries now. Germany hasn't grown its economy in 5 years. It's deindustrializing. BASF and others are offshoring all the, and so they are reducing their emissions, and they continue to plan to do so. But all that economic activity and industrialization is just going elsewhere, and so there, it's not making a change. And we can talk about sort of what the science is in terms of what represents climate change. But if you look at the metrics that I think are important, there's no sign that any of this has made any difference in that there's any inflection point at all. And so that's kind of the problem, is that to the extent that someone like me, I pay a lot of attention to what goes on in Europe, because those policy ideas, and to be honest, some of the left-leaning stuff ends up on our shores. And so we end up embracing that, and there's no one who doesn't agree that we would love to have policies that could reduce emissions to the point where we could begin to solve climate change. But nothing that we're doing now, and certainly not the Paris Accord, if you just look at sort of what's happened since then, none of that is making, we're not making a dent. And the concern is that it's really been a very large and tragic almost waste of time, money, and resources when we could have been choosing better strategies. And the fact of the matter is we haven't. And Europe's going to have to come to its own decisions. The rest of the world will come to its own decisions. And maybe they'll be the same, or maybe they won't. But we're going to have to make better decisions as to how we try to achieve this.
Yeah. Well, Doug, you'd mentioned coal, which I found interesting. And I had heard that, we had shut down or reduced coal usage in the United States, and that China had, I think, more coal plants on slate to start up than we had shut down in the last several years. And I'd mentioned that basically a lot of countries that are trying to deindustrialize and reduce their emissions, the other emerging countries are just ramping up, right? So they're like India, China, they're growing, industrializing and growing emissions. So being a global problem with global climate change, I mean, I don't really think that even a few nations, if they met their target, would matter when other nations are not. So can you speak to the challenges on trying to get all the entire world to meet these and reduce together?
Right. So if you look at the last several decades, the common, now I don't know who broke these numbers out, but it's generally understood that the last few decades, the economic growth and globalization, including the benefits of affordable and clean energy, that has had emissions associated with it, have lifted 3 billion people out of poverty globally. Another 700 million of those have been lifted out of extreme poverty, And I'm not talking about energy poverty. I'm talking about poverty. So that leaves you with about 4 or 5 billion people who still would potentially want to see the same kind of improvements, right? And it actually wouldn't be that much because some of the industrial world is about 1.1. So it's closer, probably another 3 billion, think in terms of another 3 billion. So those parties and those countries and those people, they want the same kind of lifestyle that we enjoy. And that is an energy-driven lifestyle. And the fact of the matter is even if you look at the Paris Accord and some of the conversations around the Paris Accord and since, these parties have said, we will consider getting to these levels that we could, that would be consistent with us moving towards net zero, but you have to allow us to finance it. You need to finance it, industrialized world. And so these parties aren't going to pay it out of their own pockets because they understandably have said, hey guys, you are where you are because the last 100 years you use the very energy you're trying to keep us from using, and that doesn't really work for us. So if you want to pay the difference and allow us to use different energy that you say is better, you have to come up with those funds, and they need to land in our bank accounts. So there's been some promises in very large numbers thrown around. None of it is materialized. Some of it, even just the small amounts that they've been able to manage to agree upon, none of it is materialized. That includes the United States not funding some of the stuff that they had said that they would in other presidential administrations. And so, yes, the answer is that you're going to find economic activity, including emissions, sort of go to the places where they can accommodate the needs of those particular nations. And so if you take a country like UK, its focus is net zero, right? But if you take a country like China, or even a country, some other countries in Asia, Malaysia, their focus is on increasing the living standards of their billions of people in cumulative. And so that's what's going to be driving it. They're going to, in fact, just pick up the very type of energy that other countries are eschewing in their efforts to hit net zero. And, you know, there's reasons they would. The one thing I point to is that every time you get a country, a large country that decides it's no longer going to use oil, is economics say you've just increased the supply of oil available to the rest of the world. And guess what that's going to do? It's going to drop the price of oil for those parties. And guess what they'll do? They will snatch it up and they will take economic advantage of the cheap oil. And so you can't get around that. And there's other sort of things in play with Jevons paradox, which is basically the rebound effect, that every time you sort of make gains and efficiency and things like that, they're given right back because you now have the ability to actually do more because you've achieved sort of reduction in costs. And so those costs now allow certain activities that weren't economic before to become economic. And so this is all really well known. And so it's a combination of sort of shape shifting of demand across the globe, as well as these economic realities, Jevons paradox and the rebound effect, that the fact of the matter is you have to be an economist and you have to be in the energy sector to understand them. And politicians aren't economists and they aren't in the energy sector. And so they've made mistakes in their assumptions.
So given, you know, all of that, it's actually super interesting. I hadn't thought about the sort of the rebound effect and ramifications for those that aren't doing it. But, you know, when you think about the Paris Agreement, you know, and its ultimate effect on the world, I mean, we've been in it, we haven't been in it. I can't even remember if we're in it right now or not. I know that in Trump's first term, he pulled us out of it. So, but I mean, what's your overall bottom line when you think about this on the way it's shaping where we are today?
Yeah, I would say the parties that were hanging on to the Paris Climate Agreement as something that was going to, in essence, bring about real change have to accept that despite their best intentions and their best motivations and good faith efforts, it's effectively been a failure. It's not something that anyone would practically say, oh yeah, look at the difference between what we were projecting and where we are, and call it a success. And so there's some hard lessons in there, but it doesn't mean that there's not smarter strategies. We can talk about that if you'd like, but I don't want to get ahead of it in case you guys had plans for other things.
Yeah, I mean, great transition. I mean, what's the outlook on the future? I mean, what do those lessons learned look like, you know, for the next energy agreement?
So my argument would be that if we are serious about emissions, we're not going to get to net zero by 2050. But it would be a good thing if you just look at the, if you look at the science and you look at the curves and you look at the impact of climate change, if we could bend that curve, right? And there, I think there's a way that you could bend the curve without setting the globe into a economic tailspin, right? And that's in effect, if you buy into the notion that coal, as energy dense as it is a problematic fuel. If you buy into that, and maybe that's debatable, but if you buy into that and say, all right, what would it take to get countries, every country on the planet, to essentially dial down their use of coal? And so my belief is that if 15 years ago, instead of trying to pursue renewables, and especially subsidized renewables, if we had said at the time prioritized nuclear, and listen, I'm an oil and gas guy, but I think you guys are nodding your heads right now. I think we can all acknowledge that if we can get affordable nuclear in place, that would be great for everybody. And I'm not just saying the United States. I think everybody could benefit from that. I understand there's safety issues around it, but I also talked to some people who really know how the process works. And there is a lot of low-hanging fruit in terms of the ability to reduce the cost in nuclear. The other thing is natural gas. You see the uptake of natural gas mostly through LNG globally. We now have a global market, right? And there's been some research done recently by Wood Mackenzie that was actually done to kind of correct some not very good research that was used by the Biden administration to as pretext to halt the construction of LNG and the progress of LNG in the U.S. And so if we can get to a point where we have affordable and reliable LNG landing on the shores of Europe and Asia, that would give those countries the ability to, it wouldn't be the cheapest form of energy in terms of what we get in the U.S., but it's still competitive with nuclear, and it's certainly competitive with renewables when you put all-in costs of renewables in play. And so that would reduce, that is the, and the premium paid for LNG, to the extent that there is one, is essentially the price you're paying to try to reduce emissions. The other two things I would say is hydro is another, it's a net zero, and it's been proven. There's not a lot of locales where you could do it, but there are some. And so that is a kind of energy that does make sense. And the fourth one I would mention is geothermal. Geothermal, in my mind, has the characteristics to be a good, solid, baseload, dispatchable thermal generation that we could use. It doesn't exist everywhere, but if you talk to some of the drillers, they say, you know, this is a technology, and there's heat issues. It's incredibly hot in some of these formations, but they're working through it. And my feeling is that's the kind of thing that we should, if we had a package of those four, in addition to a plan where we worked on adaptation of climate, because I think climate is clearly rising. We didn't talk about sort of my belief on the science, but I'm a buyer in. I'm not a denier of climate change in any respect. I follow Jim Hansen and Scott Tinker and Roger Pilkey, and I've read and Stephen Koonin, and these are all serious guys, right? And they've convinced me that the greenhouse effect is a real thing, and it's something we need to deal with. And so, to me, all those four factors that I mentioned to you, they wouldn't reduce emissions to the point of net zero. I think it's impractical that we expect that we would get there, but it would bend the curve to the point where we would begin to see the high cases in the IPCC forecasts for future temperatures to begin to fall away. And so then you've got a situation where you remove the scare factor. And the scare factor right now is that we would reach 3 degrees Celsius over pre-industrial levels by the end of the century. So you would begin to sort of introduce the notion that maybe you'd be at 2.8, 2.7, maybe even 2.6, thereby buying yourself another 15, 20, 25, 30 years to figure out a better way to deal with this. And so the way I look at it is if we were to do those things plus invest lower amounts of money than we've done in the subsidization of renewables and other things and the tax giveaways that we've given, but just focus on R&D, right? And this is, it's a lot more bang for the buck. And that's really what the role of the government should be, is R&D, fundamental R&D that industry really can't do as much, or certainly can't do as effectively. And then let sort of the magic of the market and technology work its magic. And it's probably going to be, as Stephen Koonin says, a second half of the century issue in terms of when we decide it really needs to sort of become a global issue and one that we deal with. And we should be using technologies and approaches and understandings that exist in 2065, not in 2015. And that's just the practical approach. One last thing I'll tell you in terms of net zero, I don't know if you guys follow Mark Mills, but he's got some interesting takes. And I remember early on, when probably 4 years ago, and he was on a podcast and he said, you know, the quick go-to is that if we can put a man on the moon, we can fix climate change. And the fact of the matter is he said, this is a terrible analogy, because putting a single man on the moon when a single country is in charge with all the inputs is a lot easier than what we're trying to do with fixing climate change globally, which would be like putting all of mankind on the moon, you know, and all nations had to cooperate and contribute. It's just not going to happen. And so some things just aren't doable. And I think the net zero on the time frame that we've been told we need to achieve is not doable. And therefore, it leans on, all right, what can you do? What's the smart thing to do? We don't have endless amounts of money. And what can you do from an adaptation standpoint?
Well, you bring up a great point. I'm sorry to interject here. I know some of the guys had some questions, but, you know, I think one of the issues in my brain that I can't get over is this, it's just a blanket agreement, right? It's like, hey, the whole world, we're going to do this, right? And this particular solution is going to solve your plan. But as you mentioned with geothermal, right, you can do geothermal in relatively specific places and not everywhere. Similarly, why can't that be said for, you know, solar in Arizona, right? It doesn't hail, there's not tornadoes, it's 100 degrees all the time. I always fly into Arizona and I'm like, why doesn't every roof have solar on it? But, you know, why do you think that these folks need to issue these blanket statements or these blanket agreements that it's a one size fits all solution when the earth is an extremely complex thing? You know, we can have various solutions at various places.
Right. I think it's groupthink, one thing. I just did an analysis with using 2024 costs provided by the Energy Department for construction of solar and natural gas plants. And what comes out, and I did it by state, I looked at the plant inlet costs by state for natural gas, for natural gas plants. And then I looked at the capacity factors for solar by state, which matter, right? And that's a big deal. How sunny is it, and how much of it does the sun shine over the course of a year? And so there's a few states where it comes out where it does make sense to, at least as things are, to go with solar. One is, the best example is California. Southern California is incredibly sunny, right? It's kind of like West Texas. And they have very high capacity factors, probably among the highest in the nation. The problem is that because of state policy, the inlet price of natural gas in 2024 was about $12. And so what's happened is solar has become economic, not because solar is a particularly good form of energy, even in Southern California, but the state has successfully made the alternatives so expensive. Right. It also exists in Florida, very sunny, kind of what I call unnaturally high natural gas prices, which is kind of unusual. I presume it's probably a result of growth. And then there's a few other states where the gas prices are so high, mostly in the Northeast, where they've kind of forced solar to the, even with the lower capacity factors, lower amounts of sunshine. But no one goes and does that. That's, you know, that analysis probably took me 30 hours, right, to do, and took me another 100 hours to build the models, which I built for other reasons, but I had the models. And so that's not how politicians think. They're looking for what are my counterparts saying in other states? What is Europe saying? And they're looking to sort of hit the buzzwords that are being hit by the media. The media is another problem. They don't do that kind of detail. And so I think that the real problem with the inability to kind of pick and choose and allow the markets to pick and choose is that we have too much industrial policy, we have too much government meddling, and when you get that, you get distortions, and as a result, you've got states that are building lots of renewables purely because of the subsidies. And I will tell you, when I did that analysis, Texas had natural gas inlet costs of about $3.70 per MMBTU last year. That was far more economic to go with gas fired generation than it would have been with solar, notwithstanding what the solar industry would say, even with the very high levels of sunshine in Texas. So there's only about five or six states, at least on 2004 conditions, that you could make the argument that we should be going with these different, with those particular technologies. But your point's a good one. You know, it's, you know, natural gas is prevalent in the Appalachians and in Texas and some of the Gulf Coast area. It probably makes sense that they'd be the ones, but it doesn't mean that you couldn't still do that. It's still not the best choice if you've got transportation of natural gas and the pipeline development the way it needs to be. And so we're just not in a situation where the market is deciding. We're in a situation where government strategy and government industrial policy is deciding what should be emphasized.
Interesting. Oh, see Stuart jumping in there. Oh, Brian, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I was going to mention, you know, we're kind of talking about prevention of increasing rising in temperatures. I know there's probably early on this, a lot of R&D needs to be needed, but is there any talk or information about abatement of CO2 in the atmosphere, sequestering of those types of things as part of the overall reduction?
So are you speaking of like carbon storage and that kind of thing? Or is that what you're speaking to?
Yeah, primarily. Yeah.
So it's probably not. The problem is that it's such a large issue. It's, if you look at greenhouse gas concentrations in the atmosphere, at the Paris Accord 2015, they were about 399 parts per million. Over the course of the 10 years since, they have risen to, I think it's, you know, the last number I had, and maybe then in 2024 was about 422 424, I think it was. And so when you look at that curve, that is the greenhouse gas, the greenhouse effect, and that is the thing that causes temperatures to rise. There is virtually no indication at all that we have made any change in that curve. And it's actually accelerating, but it was always implied that it would, because it's kind of a geometrically rising curve. Some of it has to do with mankind increasing the amounts, but it also has to do with, as the Earth warms, the ocean itself releases more CO2. And so it's all in there. You can see it. And so when you look at some of these large projects that ExxonMobil and others are trying to do in terms of carbon sequester, I get it, because at the very least, you know, you've captured that molecule and you know it's underground and it's out of the picture, but it's not really going to be, it's not the most cost effective way you could do it. You could get much more bang for your buck by trying to replicate what the United States did with shale natural gas and basically wring out all the coal generation. Try to do that globally, certainly in industrialized countries, get the coal out of the industrialized countries, limit it in the developed countries, and then you would begin to see the curve in the projections going forward begin to become more hospitable, and it would remove this worst case scenario and some of the panic that's around that. Because we have to send a more honest message to the younger generations that this isn't something that they should necessarily feel to be an existential threat, but it is something they need to be watchful of, and that we are, but it's something they can adapt to and deal with. And so the scare tactics aren't helping anybody. And to the extent that we can kind of remove those from the conversation by following good, smart strategy, including nuclear and other things like that, that would be the way to go. The other thing I'll mention, and not to complicate matters, but Daniel Yergin came out with a piece in Foreign Affairs with Peter Orszag, who was in the Obama administration, and then another person who works with Yergin at S&P Global. And they put out a piece, and effectively, if you read through that, they've effectively said the energy transition that we're attempting has failed. In my mind, that came right up to the edge, never said it, but they were very clear that the things that we're talking about today are real and that we need a better plan, right? And so we're at a point where we need to develop some new blueprints. Even parties with Daniel Yergin, who I think is a very even-handed guy and hasn't been a cheerleader one way or another, when they've come out and said objectively these things, the things that we're pointing to don't suggest that we're making any progress in what we've decided is a big project and an important project, I think people need to listen. And so I don't know if they have, but that's kind of the thing. It's one of the reasons it's what I'm focusing on right now was, hey, let's go back and look and see what kind of success we're having with this energy transition. And the beginning date should be the Paris Climate Agreement, because that's when it all kicked off. And the fact of the matter is there's not much sign really in anywhere in the science and the politics and the economics, whatever it may be, that we're making that much progress at all. Let me mention one other thing too, is there is a mistaken policy approach that gets kind of wonky, but it's true. And this is something that Yergin spoke to, is that there's this inclination to subsidize new stuff, right? And you guys are definitely on top of the addition of energy, right? And so that's what we've done with renewables, is we've just sort of added a new energy source. And in certain markets, you could claim that it does replace others, right? And that would be an example in Texas. There's no parties willing to build natural gas plants in Texas now. And that's because the renewables and the configuration of renewables, as they take sort of the middle section of the day and a lot of the energy volumes, they've just sort of ruined the economics for natural gas. And then batteries are taking the peaking. And so as a result, dispatchable natural gas, which is essential for any grid, is not developing on Texas. And so you could argue that we're going to burn less natural gas over time in Texas, but that's just being picked up elsewhere. We're just going to export that gas, and someone else is going to use the gas that we're not using. And so there is no net gain there. And that's the problem with subsidizing stuff to give them a reason to generate energy that really may not need to be generated, certainly at those costs and in those manners. And so it gets you to the point where, all right, well, what would the right policy be? And the right policy from that standpoint, if you're serious about it, would be a carbon tax. But the problem with the carbon tax is it's not necessarily, certainly not high levels. It's not going to be tolerable. It wouldn't be tolerable in the United States, but we've tolerated, you know, we pay an aggregate $75 billion in gasoline taxes, both at the federal and the state level every year. And so we do have excise tax on energy that we live with, but that 18 plus cent tax hasn't changed in years because politicians believe it to be something that they don't really want to touch, as a third rail, as they say in politics. And so there's this governor out there that says, well, you could go out there and apply a carbon tax, but the beauty of a carbon tax is that it would, in fact, whatever you set it at, it would have an effect where you would diminish what you're trying to diminish, emissions, and thereby, from a comparison standpoint, other things might appear more attractive. But the other thing I'd say about it is there is a nice governor effect, because I don't think the public's going to allow it to be too high, right? And so I get in a lot of pushback from my followers on LinkedIn and others about that particular argument. But economically, it is better economic policy than subsidizing stuff, because at the end of the day, a tax could actually have the benefit, the effect that you're looking for from an emissions standpoint.
Interesting.
And that would be, you know, ideally you'd have the same tax globally. It's going to differ, you know, depending on Europe and UK are going to have higher ones. But those are the kind of tools that would make sense if you were really serious about it, this, and maybe soft mandates too. But then again, as long as if you can keep getting reelected, but with mandates and taxes, good luck, right? You need to be prudent about that. But the subsidy approach just isn't working. It makes politicians feel good, but we're not, it's just, we're wasting time, money, and resources on what is an important issue.
Well, I'll throw mine out, but I don't know if it's a fast one, but we'll see. So Doug, just curious your thoughts on, I guess you kind of mentioned geopolitics at the very beginning, but we're in a world where there's actually, at least at this point, two kind of issues, two kind of altercations happening, Russia, Ukraine, and now Iran and Israel. And so just how does that impact all that we've been talking about this past few minutes.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. That's something I actually brushed over. I should have mentioned it. But when you get into the idea of sort of the participation of the 196 countries in the Paris Agreement, inevitably there are going to be conflicts, whether it's in the Middle East or whether it's, if you know what's going on in Africa right now, that are both regional. And then you're also going to have issues that are global, right? There's going to be times, whether it's COVID or whether it's, you know, things like that, you're going to find times and have times inevitable that nations and regions and sometimes the entire globe are going to push the issue of climate change to the back burner. And the reason is because it will have to do with either their survival in the case of war, right? Or it would be that the economic circumstances require that you cannot continue to use high cost energy, even though there may be a need to try to reduce emissions. Those kind of practicalities are going to carry the day, and that they are not the kind of things that were ever considered, in my opinion, in the Paris Climate Agreement and in the analyses and the forecast in the wake of that. They just, no one really thought of that. And I think, you know, as an example with what's going on in Ukraine, Europe is, you know, burning coal now, you know, a ton in certain places. So certainly did more. They've got better answers now because we've been able to get more LNG to them. But, you know, who would have forecasted that? But they're all in there. And so if you take an expected value approach to this and look at probabilities of events, it further haircuts your ability to actually try to achieve. And that's not being pessimistic. That's just being realistic, right? And there are untold numbers of events that are going to occur going forward that we can't predict right now, but they're all going to have implications on our ability actually to try to become more green. And not, and most of them, many of them will make it such that our efforts will become harder, not easier.
Well, Doug, thank you for coming on. Really appreciate it. I feel like we could go for another hour if we needed to. So maybe we'll have you on here again soon. But typically we like to end and wrap up with, you know, you're on our show here again in, let's just say, a year or two, and things are going good in your world. Or in this, you know, world that we're talking about here. So what has gone well over the next couple of years that has caused you to be in a good mood, to feel good?
Sure. So I think the idea that we've got Chris Wright in the Department of Energy, he's a very smart guy. He seems to have a right perspective about nuclear to me. And I'm not talking about just the small modular reactors, although I consider those interesting. But nuclear, I think, has really been hampered by some bad policy making, some bad perception, and to be honest, some bad shepherding of the technology from within the Department of Energy and maybe even the nuclear industry as a whole. So that would be one thing that I'm actually pretty encouraged by. And I think if we can get past the taboo of nuclear in our backyards, which is, you know, kind of a wrong way of analysis, but that's the way people feel about it, I think that would be a great gain. And so, you know, the SMRs is kind of interesting and exciting. I hope it works out. Then the other thing is LNG. I look at this and I've done some analysis that in the same way that I did the state analysis, and I looked at the landed cost of LNG from US, which would be mostly Haynesville gas is the way sort of the pricing seems to be. And, you know, it's about $9 per inland BTU, which sounds high to us, but Europe paid higher prices than that. They could get that price down if they blended it with some of their own production, which is offshore in most cases, but they actually do have some onshore reserves that they kind of refuse to develop. And so that could be a blended price that could fall even further. And then you got a situation where you in fact are allowing parties who want to focus on, say, you know, low carbon. They're using natural gas. I think that haven't done the math for what it would be in Asia, but at the same time, if you can just get these parties to accept natural gas and LNG as a net add and point to the United States with what was achieved from an emission standpoint with our use of natural gas and emphasis on the natural gas, I think that there's reason to be encouraged there. The last thing I'd say is, I don't think a lot of our best minds and money and resources have been spent much on adaptation. I think that if you went and looked at the amount of research and the amount of understanding related to what it would take to reduce emissions is far, far, far greater than what we've done in terms of adaptation. I think we're starting to get there now. And I think there's some things we can do. I think there's things that the world is already going to do. My understanding is India is already, the sales of air conditioners are already kind of going through the roof, which is personally, I'm glad to see. I worry about the countries like that where it gets so hot. You know, I think that once we start to focus on the idea that it's not all what I would consider mitigation of emissions, some of it will be adaptation. And the more that we start focusing on adaptation, I think the better. So those are three reasons I think we should be encouraged. The other thing I'd point to is I think if we can make some good decisions and develop some technologies that are a little more cost effective, once we begin to bend that curve, there's some other things in the math that I won't get into, but it really does benefit us from the ability to bend the curve. And then we start looking at that 3 degrees Celsius over pre-industrial levels as being something well into next century rather than this century. And I think that's a good thing.
Great stuff, Doug. Thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it. Brian and Stuart, any parting comments?
Yeah, it was great information, Doug. Really appreciate you being on.
Thanks, guys. It's my pleasure. Enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you for listening to the Let's Clear the Air Energy Podcast. If you like what you have heard, subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcast app. You can email us with questions or comments to Let's Clear the Air Energy Podcast @gmail.com.